Good afternoon and welcome to Soundbites, edition of December 3rd, 1989. I'm Bob Smith, and you'll definitely want to stay with us this hour because during the first segment of the program, right after the latest news, we ask the question, could your video monitor be hazardous to your health? We're going to be getting some answers to this question, which has been making the news everywhere from the Wall Street Journal to USA Today, with Lewis Flesson of Video Display Times. He'll have the latest on all the research and the product changes we've been hearing about. Then during the second segment of the program, Bob Wallace of QuickSoft. Yes, he's the man who helped create the world of shareware with his popular PC Write word processing program, and he'll be on live line with us during the second half of the show. Then Nick Francesco shares his thoughts on IBM and Microsoft. And forget about what you own. All that coming up later in the program, but first, the latest computer news. We're following the continuing controversy over whether computer video display terminals are hazardous to your health. The giant of the computer industry, IBM, says its new terminals will all meet new European standards for reducing low-frequency emissions, starting with new workstations for mainframes and wide-area networks just released this fall. We asked IBM ergonomics advisor George Mine why the changes are being made.
There were a couple of studies that were done in the Scandinavian countries, in Sweden and Denmark, with rodents, that indicated that there was an increase in malformations and in miscarriages in rodents that suggested that these fields might be causing those. And that was translated, that concern was translated by people in labor to mean that that might also apply to human beings.
Mine says there is no evidence that the computer terminal you now work with will actually do you any harm, even with long-term continuous exposure. But that is contested by a number of health authorities in Europe and America based on those animal studies. So IBM is responding to concerns in the marketplace by changing its designs. Most IBM PC and PS2 products will not be designed or retrofitted right away, but forthcoming monitor redesigns in the next 12 to 24 months are expected to incorporate the same modifications. We'll be taking an in-depth look at the computer video display terminal issue in just a few minutes here on Soundbites. More of you in business are buying more personal computers now than ever before. The Association of Systems Management says its members report heavy increases in spending, especially for personal computers and PC networks, which are now being asked to do work once reserved for larger minis and mainframes. 73% of those surveyed nationwide report more spending on PC hardware, and 63% are putting increased dollars into networking their machines. In the second of our two-part look at the software field, we wanted to know where future growth in software development and sales will be. So, we turned again to Ken Wash, the executive director of the Software Publishers Association, to find out what his members have in store for us in the user community. One thing we can expect, according to Wash, is for a few major publishers to take over the most popular applications.
The companies that have grown to be the four or five largest in the industry are those that have grown on the basis of the largest applications. The mainstream applications, word processing, spreadsheets, and databases, so that smaller boutique software companies fill in around the edges in a number of other applications. The graphics area happens to be one that has a lot of smaller players in it.
But Wash says specialized applications will provide resourceful programmers with big opportunities. There is a new major player in the PC market. Unisys Corporation has won a contract to supply the Air Force with up to a quarter million desktop PCs. That's worth close to $750 million over the next 5 years. Industry observers say this will give Unisys the marketing and manufacturing push it needs to challenge other major PC manufacturers in other business and government markets. Just when you thought a computer couldn't get any smaller, a new circuit board from Chips and Technologies Company has made it possible to have a machine with the power of an IBM XT based on a circuit board the size of a credit card. No products based on the board have yet been announced, but Chips and Technologies marketing boss Vinod Mahendru says those should be forthcoming soon. He adds even more powerful handheld personal computers based on the Intel 286 chip are now under development. Well, Texas Instruments got bad news and good news this week. The bad news, they're furloughing 1,500 employees temporarily until demand for their products catches up with inventories. The good news comes from Japan, where after 30 years, the Japanese government finally recognized the validity of TI's 1960 patent application on the basic design of integrated circuits. Leaving aside possible past due royalties, STI will collect over $600 million a year for each of the next 10 years from Japanese manufacturers. You looking for that hard-to-find gift for your favorite computer buff? Consider SafeDisk. It's described by its inventor as a poly-floppy disk condom. Stephen Nabity says, tongue-in-cheek, the idea is to protect the disks against computer viruses. The condoms don't really do that, but they make an interesting stocking stuffer. And that's this week's Computer News. This segment concerns every single PC user. That's right. This is the question of whether your monitor is hazardous to your health. Louis Flesson is the editor of Video Display Times, and he is on the live line with us from New York City right now to tell us whether we are at risk from our computer-related jobs and pastimes. And, of course, your chance to make contact and find out more about this issue if you have a question is as close as your telephone at 263-WXXI. That is 263-9994, where we invite you to call in on this segment, which could have a bearing on every single one of us. Louis, good to have you with us this hour.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, first of all, we got attention drawn to this as a result of the IBM announcement that they were making modifications in some of their monitors. What did that announcement mean? What are they doing, and why are they doing it?
Basically, IBM announced that its new line of terminals called InfoWindow will be shielded from one type of electromagnetic field. And all terminals that IBM will make now in beginning in 1990 will be shielded from that magnetic field.
But, of course, that magnetic field, I'm sure, is puzzling a lot of people because we don't really know what it does. And I'm wondering, first of all, what does the research say about why we should be worried about this in the first place?
Basically, a series of experiments done in Sweden over the last few years have shown that this type of magnetic field, called a very low frequency or VLF magnetic field, can harm the development of the mice embryo. Basically, this research was undertaken after office workers started reporting problem pregnancies in the so-called clusters that were reported all over the United States, Canada, and Europe. Those clusters were generally discounted as freak or chance events, but the strong unions in Sweden asked the government to do these mice studies, and they showed, much to everyone's surprise, I might add, that these weak electromagnetic fields from VDTs could do precisely what people were finding in the clusters.
So as a result, some of people's fears and suspicions and worries were actually coming true.
That's exactly right. Now, just to put this matter in perspective, we don't know what the effects of these fields are on humans. These were mice studies, and we really cannot extrapolate directly from mice to humans. However, it does clarify one very important aspect, and that is that these extremely weak magnetic fields can have biological effects. When we started reporting about these clusters in the early 1980s, most experts really dismissed the idea that such weak magnetic fields could have such profound effects. I think we've gone beyond that step, and now we know that these fields have biological effects. The real question is, are they hazardous to human beings?
Sounds like we've got a little bit of debate going here, because when I was talking with the IBM people, with George Mine, their environmental and their ergonomics expert this past week, he said that he found no evidence that would satisfy him that there's anything for a human being to worry about. Do I take it from what you've said that you're not quite so sure?
I would dispute George Mine's assertions there. Basically, we don't have any human data, but of course you can't do those kinds of experiments. We do have one extremely important piece of evidence, however. Last year, a Kaiser Permanente healthcare provider in Oakland, California, reported after a study of pregnant women that VDT operators who worked for more than 20 hours a week during the first trimester had a doubling of miscarriages. Now, you know, they did not say that it was electromagnetic fields that were responsible for this. They said it could have been stress. It could have been ergonomics, that is, the way you sit at the terminal. Of course, it could have been a chance event. But, you know, at this point, we now have the clusters, which are circumstantial, I know, but still a data point. We have the epidemiological data, that is, among humans, and we have the mice experiments from Sweden showing the electromagnetic fields can have precisely the effects that we see in the epidemiological studies and the clusters. For me, that's enough to change the burden of proof onto those who say there are no risks to prove it, rather than those who say there is a risk.
And that risk may be coming from these really low-frequency radiations below the radio band, below any band that we would think of as operating electronic gear, then?
Absolutely. I mean, these fields have long been thought to be benign and have no effect on human health, and now we just can't be so sure.
Now, of course, we don't know why it does what it does, if in fact it does it, do we?
That's correct. I mean, that's one major stumbling block. The physicists do not have a good mechanism of interaction to explain how these fields can have such effects. But listen, I mean, there are a lot of environmental contaminants out there that we don't know how they operate also. I mean, the classic example is asbestos. We all now agree that asbestos is a highly potent carcinogen, yet we don't know the mechanism of interaction there either.
Now, of course, you've also, in conversations that we had before this broadcast, mentioned some recent studies about this kind of radiation coming from other sources, like phone lines, power lines, and the rest, that would also give some people some pause, too. Is that even more suggestive evidence that maybe we've got a problem here?
Absolutely. Basically, the papers across the country last week ran stories of a preliminary study out of Johns Hopkins University Public Health School, where they studied telephone linemen who were exposed to a different kind of magnetic field, a so-called extremely low-frequency or power line magnetic field. Now, let me say that VETs emit two types of magnetic fields, the type we've just been talking about, the VLF, or very low-frequency, but they also emit extremely low-frequency fields, much like the one studied at Johns Hopkins. No one is shielding against those ELF fields, including IBM's new monitor line. This new study out of Johns Hopkins showed that those who worked with ELF fields had a generalized increase in cancer that was extremely surprising and extremely disconcerting. The field levels that they were exposed to were relatively very low. In fact, the same kinds of fields that one might expect near terminals. So it opens the question, now that VLF has been addressed by IBM, whether or not they should hurry up and address the ELF fields also.
Now, one thing I'm curious about there, we know about the VLF fields. You mentioned them mostly affecting women, and especially women in childbearing situations. These ELF radiations, they affect men as well as women, too? Are men just as much at risk from these?
Absolutely. We know, in fact, much, much more about ELF fields than we know about VLF fields because there are so many homes near power lines and so many people, like electrical workers, who work with these fields all the time. There are now approximately 25 different studies from around the world linking these ELF fields to cancer in occupational settings. There are three independent studies showing cancer among children living next to high current power lines. We know a great deal about ELF now, and surprisingly, the ELF issue has not blossomed with respect to VETs, when in fact the ELF fields from VETs are stronger than the VLF fields that have been more discussed.
So what it's coming down to is we're in danger, all people are potentially in danger from this. Now, first question, then, is it just short-term exposure, occasional casual exposure, or do you have to be sitting in front of a machine, do you have to be sitting in front of your monitor for long periods of time, day after day after day, to be exposed and be in danger?
Unfortunately, we don't have the answer to that very, you know, sensible question. We can't give advice. I mean, at this point, in the absence of data, one has to assume that less is better, and that when, you know, the more breaks people take, and the when you're not using the terminal, turn it off. Don't just leave it on there because it will be emitting those magnetic fields whether you're working on them or not. So, you know, in the absence of good data, one has to, you know, assume at least at the moment a dose response relationship, less is better.
So the more you're exposed, the more likely you are perhaps to endanger yourself then.
You know, at this point, in the absence of data, one has to conclude that. I mean, let me say this. The United States has really shirked its responsibilities in terms of looking at these risks. We don't have a single experiment going on today in the United States, or have we ever, on the effects of VDT-type electromagnetic fields on animals or humans. We have not done this work, and it's about time that we do. In fact, we haven't even done the measurements that would tell me whether a PS2, say, has a higher VLF or ELF magnetic field than, say, a Macintosh. We can't even say whether one Macintosh will have a greater field than a second Macintosh in another room. We're not playing with a full deck here.
So we have no way even of measuring the machines that are out there in the field to find out what the problem is?
We can measure them. No one has done a systematic survey. I mean, I would suggest that it's about time that the FDA or the EPA contact the National Bureau of Standards and have them, their premier group of researchers, do these measurements. In a couple months, we would have the data, and then the computer user, the American consuming public, could make its own decisions. And in Sweden, for instance, they have opted for the low magnetic field units.
Are millions of us then potentially at risk?
I would say so. I mean, I don't want to panic anyone because we don't know much about these ELF risks vis-a-vis the VDTs. But there's absolutely no work going on. I don't know how to emphasize that. We have 30 to 40 million people working on these on the job every day, plus countless millions others in schools, at homes, and we have not the vaguest idea the implications of it for their health. And frankly, I mean, I don't know how many people it will take to be working on these before we take it seriously, but I think it's about time.
If this surprises, shocks you, puzzles you, or you're wondering what you can do about the potential danger that you've just heard about, we invite you to address your questions right to us at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. That is how you link up with Sound Bites, and that is how you get a chance to talk with Louis Flessen, the editor of Video Display Times, who is talking about some of the dangers that have been highlighted in recent stories, potential dangers we might underscore, since, as Mr. Flessen said a moment ago, we don't have any conclusive studies right now to find out whether some of the radiation that you're getting from your control system, from your monitor, from your personal computer, is dangerous or not to you. But there's enough suggestive evidence out there that it may require further investigation, as Mr. Flessen is pointing out. And if you're curious about it, we invite you to address your questions to us right now at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And we'll get to the phones right away. Good afternoon. You're on the air. Go ahead, please. Good afternoon. You're on the air with us. Please go ahead. Can you hear us?
Yes,
go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Well, I am surprised that you and your guest are surprised about the power of electromagnetic rays. I remember reading an article in a scientific journal several years ago warning the public about the big electromagnetic poles and wires that were going from one field to another out in farm areas, and how they were affecting the cows that were under them, and they stressed that human beings would be affected too by these powerful rays. So I don't know why we're so surprised now. I think it's time we woke up. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. I had not been aware of that particular study of agricultural animals. Were you, Lewis?
If I may comment, the power line, these high-tension, high-voltage power lines that crisscross America have long been suspected of being problems. However, the fields we're talking about here are very, very small. I mean, most people just ignored them until experimental studies showed that they could be biologically active. So, you know, what we're talking about is lowering the threshold of ill effects by, you know, say, a factor of 100, perhaps 1,000, and still getting some kind of biological effect. Let me take 1 second here to clarify one other point, and that is one thing people can do is to realize that these fields decay rather quickly with distance. So if they can adjust the point size of the type on the computer terminal, they can move their chair backwards a little bit, and that will decay the field. So by about 4 feet away from your terminal, the levels really go down quite significantly.
Of course, other than just backing away from your terminal and stretching out that cord with the keyboard in front of you, I'm wondering what else you can do to shield your equipment. We have an off-air caller who wants to particularly know what you can do about that.
In terms of the magnetic field, really there is nothing that you can add to your computer terminal at this point in time which will reduce those magnetic fields. Magnetic fields go through everything except certain very specialized metals. And, there's nothing you can add on to the front of it or even to the side of it that will take care of this. There are screens on the market that will shield against the electric field and attenuate the electric static charge that can build up on terminals. But the magnetic field is a different matter, and we just can't deal with it at the moment.
I don't know if this is going to sound like a dumb question or not, but would it make any difference if you crank down the brightness control on your monitor?
No. Basically, it's got to do with the deflection coils that move the electron beam at the heart of the cathode ray tube around. So it really doesn't matter. In fact, Swedish studies, and the Swedes are so far ahead of us, it's embarrassing, have shown that picture quality has nothing to do with the magnetic field intensity.
I wondered about that because it sort of seemed logical that if you crank up the intensity of the beam, you might be cranking up intensity of radiation, but that has nothing to do with it, huh?
No, you've got to move that beam around and to draw the letters and characters and pictures on the face of the screen, and it's those changes that create the magnetic field.
Something else I wonder before we get to our next call. Other circuits within the computer itself, the central processing unit, do they emit any of this type of radiation, or is that a lot higher frequency?
It tends to be higher frequency, and it also tends to be of an even lower intensity. But here again, we haven't got any measurements. Measurements are the simplest part of this problem because we know how to do them, and experts could do them relatively quickly. The biology is very complicated and will take years to clarify. But with the measurements, we could have a report on everybody's desk in 3 months if the government wanted to do it.
Something else before I get to the next call, that a lot of people work with laptops and portables that don't use these TV-style monitor screens. They use the liquid crystal displays or gas plasma. Are those safer?
I've not seen very many measurements on gas plasmas, but in an LCD, the distinction we want to make here is whether or not it is backlit. If there's no backlighting, then the LCD is relatively radiation-free. If there is backlighting, there can be some ELF-type emission, power line-type emissions, from the fluorescent tubes that backlight it. There is a company in Massachusetts that is now selling shielded backlit LCDs.
Do the phones again at 263-WXXI. Hi, you're on the air on Sound Bites.
Hi. There's another problem that I would like to bring up that I don't think was addressed today. When my daughter graduated from college, she had perfect vision, 20/20. After a year of working in front of a terminal, and this was all day sitting in front of the terminal on the phone, but still in front of the terminal, she moved out of state and had to take a new driving test for her out-of-state license. And she was shocked to find that she did not pass the vision test. Her sight had gone down so gradually that she just wasn't aware that she wasn't seeing anywhere near as much as she did before. Her vision had gone down quite a bit. She needs glasses now, and it seems like too much of a coincidence that just this year, when she was in front of the terminal constantly, that her vision should have changed so radically. And I wonder if other people have.
This problem is another one that begs more research to be done. There some very extensive studies have shown that there are no no effects on the glaucoma and cataracts at this point in time. However, for the kind of changes that you are talking about, there are indications from some research at University of California, Berkeley, that shows that VDT operators have a trouble after long periods of time in focusing, and that would, of course, affect their vision. Here again, we are straggling far back on what kind of work should be done, and there's practically no work being done on the long-term effects of vision of these operators. And, you know, I can't tell you, whether there is any correlation now, because people's eyesight does deteriorate with age, and you can't say what is natural and what has been done by the terminal, but there is suggestive evidence out there that we need, that there could be a link, and that we need a great deal more work.
Right, of course.
Let me just add one more thing, that just because we were talking about radiation, there is no suggestion at this point that this is caused by radiation.
And thank you very much for calling. We take another call at 263-WXXI. Good afternoon. You're on the air on Sound Bites.
Good afternoon, Bob. I'm very excited to hear this topic on your show. I've been following this issue for about 6 months to or a year now, pretty closely. And actually, quite by accident, about 6 months ago, I came across what looks like could be very beneficial product to the community. It's actually a shielding device for low-frequency electromagnetic fields. And I have one myself. It's quite effective. It has evolved over the years. It started out as a simple box with a bunch of electronics in it. And today it's in the form of a very nice-looking watch, which has a microchip in it. It's really the microchip, not the watch, that does the shielding. And I thought it might be important to tell people out there that if they are at all concerned, there is a product available they can buy.
I have to interject. I know about this watch, and I really do think that it is... I have to say that I don't think this watch works at all, I'm afraid, and I think that it is leading people down the wrong path in terms of there's no way in the world that chip could be protecting you against these magnetic fields. And I'm afraid that people who get this kind of watch will be lulled into a false sense of security and not take the kinds of precautions they should be taking.
And we have time for one more quick call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm interested also, it may be related, in full-spectrum fluorescent lighting, and I just bought some and changed them in my house, and I was wondering if there's any relationship between the type of waves that are given off by full-spectrum light and also the video display terminal.
These are two fairly separate research areas, but there is a great deal of interest in the effects of fluorescent lighting on human behavior. There are all sorts of different kinds of fluorescent lights you can buy, and there is one banker-turned-researcher, Mr. Ott, O-T-T, in Florida, has done some very suggestive experiments showing the impact of these fluorescent lights. But frankly, we haven't done very much research here again on the effects of fluorescent lights on health, and it begs more work.
And I thank you very much for calling. I wish we had time for more calls in this segment, but I guess to wrap it up, IBM is saying, don't worry, compute happy. You're skeptical about that, right?
I think that, IBM's actions speak louder than their words. They have now shielded their terminals after saying for years that there was absolutely no risk. I hope that whatever they say, I'm glad to see, that they are shielding the terminals, and now I hope that they will go and shield them for the other type of magnetic fields, ELF. And if I may say that, people who want to stay up with this field, we are VDT News based in New York City, and we follow this very, very closely.
And Lewis Flesson of Video Display Times, thank you very much for joining us on Sound Bites.
Thank you.
You're listening to Soundbites on WXXI 1370. I'm Bob Smith. And if one man deserves the biggest share of credit for popularizing shareware, that cooperative programming phenomenon that we've been talking about quite a bit recently, Maybe Bob Wallace is that man. He's the man who created PC Write, the word processing program that surveys say is probably the number one program in the shareware field in terms of popularity. He and his QuickSoft company continue to market and update it and other programs. In this segment of the program, we're going to reach out to Bob Wallace in the Seattle area where he's on live line with us right now, and we're going to find out about shareware in particular, his work in general as well, and find out how shareware has gotten started and where it's going. And Bob, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Now, shareware itself is probably as old as the PC industry, isn't it?
Just about. I think that's true.
And how it got started is probably an interesting story in and of itself, because normally when something new gets started, there are a few companies that tend to grab dominance in it, but this has become a real cottage industry and a prospering one.
Oh, yes. It started quite a while ago with Andrew Flugelman and also Jim Button sending their programs out and encouraging people to copy them and then encouraging the people who receive them and who like them to pay for them.
Now, of course, that's an interesting sort of honor system type of thing in and of itself. A lot of people who are just getting into the PC field don't know about shareware and how it works. Do you get a lot of people actually operating on the honor system and going ahead and giving you compensation for what you do, even though, in a sense, they don't have to in order to make the program work on their machines?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. About half of our sales revenue comes from individuals sending us their money. That would be about $1 million a year for us.
Now, that means
that's quite a few people.
That means an awful lot of people, out of the goodness of their heart, basically do the right thing then.
Yes, well, there are other benefits besides the goodness of their heart, although we certainly appreciate it, the people who register just for that reason. But they also get the manual for the software. They get our telephone support. They get two free updates. There's a number of other benefits, really, when you do send us your registration money.
Now, I'm wondering, first of all, what kind of programs are most popular in this field? You do, among other things, a word processing program that's very popular.
Yes, that's true. And the more the programs that are most successful, I think, are the larger programs and the more complicated programs, where having a manual and having the technical support you can get over the phone is very useful. There are some shareware authors have written games, but those don't tend to be as successful. People, I think, tend to use up games. They play them, and then they're finished with them, and then they don't think to send the money in, although some people do still. But it's mostly the larger productivity packages that have done well.
Like the things that you'd use in a small business?
Yes.
Now, I wonder, first of all, there's something that I've often been puzzled by when I've been looking at this issue, and that is what the shareware publisher can offer versus the big boys, the competition, the guys like the Microsofts and that. You were with Microsoft for a while yourself, so you've seen it from both sides.
Yes, I've been there, and there isn't much difference, really, if you talk about the same size company. If one is doing shareware and one is doing more traditional marketing, they're really pretty similar. Shareware is a different method of marketing software, but besides that, there really isn't very much difference.
Tell you what I'm curious about, though, and that is, when you go up against the big boys, again, the Microsofts and the rest, the billion-dollar-plus companies, and you're offering a program, like, for example, I guess, was PC Write's going to be selling in 1990 for somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 to $130, right?
That's correct. That's correct. Right now it's $99, but we do expect to raise our price about April.
Okay. Microsoft Word goes for, what, $4.50, depending on what vendor you talk to?
That's about right, $450. And it shows on their bottom line. I'm a stockholder, and I see some of their earnings statements, and they make a lot of money.
And, of course, not to mention Bill Gates himself, who is a billionaire at the age of 34.
That's right.
Which is something that none of us, even those of us who have not yet reached the age of 34, can hope for. But what I kind of wonder is, let's look at the difference. Mm-hmm. What are you getting extra for almost $300 more money? I don't want to make any insidious comparisons there, but what do you get?
Well, you're working with a bigger company, and that, I guess, for some people is important. For many people, that's not really the issue. I think if a software company is a certain size, even 12 people is not a bad size for a software company. Most software companies are very small. We have about 30 people, but if you have a large enough company to provide good documentation and good software and good technical support, that should be sufficient. Many of the, there's a few Microsofts, there's a few large software companies, but most software companies are relatively small.
And most of them are almost like cottage industries then.
That's true. most of them, I would say. We're at about $2 million a year. We're probably about number 100. And if you looked at all the software companies in the United States, and so that means there are quite a few, because there are thousands of software companies. Most of them are quite a bit smaller than we are.
So you figure you'd make the top 100 then?
We'd be just at that level, about number 100.
263-WXXI, incidentally, is how you make contact with Soundbites. If you're a user of shareware, if you're a user of any of the alternative means of getting at software these days, if you've got some thoughts, comments, questions about it, we invite you to address those questions right to us at 263-WXXI, because we've got on live line right now from the Seattle, Washington area, a man who may be one of the pioneers and certainly one of the major players in the shareware field, creating a whole new sort of cottage industry alternative to the big boys. His name is Bob Wallace. He's the writer and creator of PC Write and a number of other ancillary programs through his QuickSoft company, one of the major players in the shareware field, and you can make contact with him right through your telephone at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, you mentioned something a moment ago about the difference between the two programs. I thought of Microsoft Word as one example of contrasted with PC Write. You talked about the support and the organization behind Microsoft Word, which of course is obviously a lot bigger than a 30-person company.
That's true, that's true. And they, I must admit, they do have more features, if you just count up features, than we do. Although we, at this point, have all of the major features, proportional spacing and columns, checking spelling, mail merge. We're catching up with them. We're about where they were about 18 months ago, and we intend to move a little more quickly than they do, hopefully. But they're moving on to Windows now. Microsoft Word for Windows is just about to come out. We expect to come out with our Windows product also, although it'll probably be about a year for us.
Okay, so that's coming in the fourth quarter maybe of 1990 then?
Could be, or early 1991. We want to spend some time and do a real bang-up version, so it may take us a little while.
Okay, so for about $300 more, then I'm getting some features, a few features that I wouldn't get with one of your programs. But where else is that money going? Because it can't cost $300 just to add a few extra lines of code here and there to do a few other things, can it?
Well, it certainly goes into advertising. You'll see Microsoft Word advertise much more. That's one of the big benefits to me of shareware, is I don't have to do as much advertising. I can encourage people to give their copies of PC Write to their friends, and then their friends learn about PC Write directly rather than through advertising.
Is that how it mostly spreads, word of mouth?
Yes. There are companies that help it along where you can buy the diskettes for $2, $3, $4 and then try the program yourself. Then, if you like it, you can send the registration money directly to the author.
And that's where you get the manual and everything else then?
That's right. That's right.
What else do you get? And of course, a lot of the major players in the software industry will set you up with either discounts or, I guess in some cases, even freebies as far as updates and changes and modifications and technical help to get glitches out. So what do companies like yours have to offer in contrast with that?
We give two free updates, two postcards, each good for one update. You can also use these postcards to get some of our utility programs, to get some of our other programs, our shareware diskettes. So if you get PC Write, you can also get the diskettes for PC Browse, another one of our programs. You could get our LaserJet font selector. There's a number of different utility programs. We also offer discounts on our catalog products. We have looked at many other products that help writers use word processing. This could be a thesaurus, things to check grammar, ways of putting pictures in your documents, and actual clip art pictures themselves, fonts if you're doing laser printing or even advanced dot matrix printing, ways of doing equations, ways of handling foreign languages. We've looked at a lot of these programs, and we found what we consider the best to work with PC Write. We put these into a catalog, and we offer discounts to our registered users who want to buy these programs from us. And then, of course, we support these programs. If you have a question about using one or using it with PC Write, we're there to help you out.
263-WXXI is how we help you out here on Soundbites, and let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Don't be bashful. Sir, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. I don't know whether we're going to make that call or not, but if that caller is still on the line, please go ahead and call because we've got you on the air. Well, looks like we lost that particular one. Perhaps not patient or a little bit bashful or gun-shy, but nevertheless, don't be bashful. Call us at 263-WXXI. If you do have a question, we'd be delighted to hear from you on Soundbites. That gives me a chance now to take a look at something else, which is implicit in what you said in your last question, your last answer. If there's a lot of advertising and a lot of markup in there, how much does it really cost a major company to actually put out a program? Are there real bottom-line honest costs all that much bigger, say, than yours?
They're pretty much the same, probably $10, $15 for the actual diskette, the manual printing, things like that. There's also a cost associated with technical support. We have now 8 people available to people who call in on the phone, and we, of course, we have to pay their salaries. Since they also help us develop new products and do testing on our products, it's hard to tell how much they really cost for support, but they certainly do are expensive. So there are certainly costs involved. There's also the cost of just putting it into a store. If you're looking at a Microsoft Word or a WordPerfect, the actual publisher receives about 40% of the retail cost. The rest goes to the distributor and the retailer to help them pay for their store, their salespeople.
So if he's selling a program for, let's say, $450, and Bill Gates is actually getting, maybe, if he's lucky, 180 to 200 of it back into the company coffers.
That's correct. That's what they get. And then they pay for advertising and development out of that. But they still have quite a bit left over.
So they're doing fairly well, then.
Oh, yeah.
263-WXXI is how you have a chance to make contact with one of the men who is one of the big men of the shareware industry. Bob Wallace is on the line with us from the Seattle area. And good afternoon. You're on the air.
Oh.
Go ahead, please.
One quick comment on shareware, which I have several of, and that is a major distribution is through bulletin boards.
I'd agree with that, yes.
Yeah.
That's very important.
And the other is that some companies offer a bonus to registered owners who will get other people to register with their name.
Yes, we do that. If you, when you register with us, we give you a registration number.
Oh, yeah.
You put that on your diskette, and then when you give a copy to a friend, if that friend registers, we pay you a sales commission of $25.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And we mailed out about $40,000 in registration checks over the last year.
Well, good. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling. Well, that's an interesting marketing tool. You could conceivably set up regional distributors almost like a fellow with an Amway distributorship then if you wanted to.
Well, that's true. That's true. And when I was first starting with the shareware idea, I thought that that kind of thing might be an important part. Amway and some of the other multi-level distributors, some people like that a lot, but it's possible for the marketing side to almost be more important than the product itself in something like that. So we don't really emphasize it. We don't want to say the benefits of working with Quicksoft is the commission checks you get. We want to say the benefits is the word processing. Although the commission checks are nice and certainly do show people that how much we encourage people to copy it and give copies to their friends. When I started it in 1983, of course, people were saying, don't copy software. And I said, how can I really let people know that I want them to copy my software? So I said, well, I won't just encourage them. I'll actually pay people to copy my software. And that was a very radical thing to do back then. At this point, I think people understand the shareware concept enough that I don't need the extra inducement, but I still enjoy paying out commissions. It shows people how much I like people giving my software to other people.
If this has piqued your curiosity, 263-WXXI is how you make contact with Soundbites here on WXXI 1370. And I wonder at this point about support, because you mentioned a little bit about it before, the staff that you've got to support it. And a lot of people who think about using shareware programs or just programs from smaller independent manufacturers, publishers in general, maybe not necessarily even shareware, but sort of the boutique companies, wonder about support and how it compares with some of the big boys.
Well, it depends on the size of the company. If you talk to a company and they say, yes, we have maybe 10 people and $1 million a year in sales, you're getting to a relatively established company. If it sounds small, perhaps, but with even 10 people, a company is likely to have 2 or 3 people just on technical support. And as I say, we have eight in our technical group. On the other hand, when you get down to a company and they have one or two or three people, then of course you have to wonder a little bit. However, there is a compensation working with a very small company. Often you get support directly from the programmer, and it's not unusual in that size company if you call up and say, gee, I really wish this program would do this. Often a programmer will just do it and mail you a copy that does it.
So he'll update it for you at your request.
That does happen. It also happens that you go to call to ask for something and you discover that whoever it was has decided, oh, well, this wasn't really making much money. I decided not to do anything more with the product. The risk is a little higher with an extremely small company, but sometimes you can establish a closer relationship. If you call a company like Microsoft or WordPerfect, the people you talk to on the phone will know the product very well, but they often don't work directly with the technical group that creates the product. So sometimes the people doing the programming can get a little disconnected from the actual users. That's why I like a company about our size, because we're big enough to have a good technical support group, but we're small enough so the technical support group is also the development group. So when you call up and say, gee, I really wish this would work this way, sure enough, Thursday afternoon we meet and we listen to what people are saying and try to put those in.
I wonder, now, of course, obviously, you're not going to get a chance if you call up one of the biggies to get Bill Gates on the phone or anybody like him, but what I'm wondering is the industry in general starting to get away from its users? I'm thinking of something that Wang Laboratories did, which was to send its development engineers out into the field from time to time to talk with actual users. Now, that's hardware. That's not software. But do you think that the software publishing industry could use some of the same kind of approach now?
I think so. A part of what's going on is the hardware is becoming very powerful. And a lot of people don't need that much power. Also, many applications, such as word processing, but the others as well, it's a very competitive industry, and I think the trade magazines, the PC magazine and Byte magazines, are starting to often rate products on how many features they have. They almost literally just count them up. So people start adding more and more features, and some users are saying, hey, wait, I don't need something this big, and I don't need to go through this big a manual. This is just too big and complicated for me. One thing we're doing is coming out, not only continuing with PC Write to add new features, but we're coming out with a PC Write Lite, a simplified PC Write, which I think will be a real good product for many people who get confused by products that have a lot of complicated features.
Now, what's
they want something just simple, they can get through the manual easily and get their job done without a lot of extra confusion.
What's that going to be like? What is it going to be able to do, let's say, compared to the basic PC Write? What am I giving up if I buy it, and what am I saving money-wise?
Well, you do save some money. It costs about half as much. The kind of features you give up...
I really do think that it is... I have to say that I don't think this watch works at all, I'm afraid, and I think that it is leading people down the wrong path in terms of there's no way in the world that chip could be protecting you against these magnetic fields. And I'm afraid that people who get this kind of watch will be lulled into a false sense of security and not take the kinds of precautions they should be taking.
And we have time for one more quick call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm interested also, it may be related, in full-spectrum fluorescent lighting, and I just bought some and changed them in my house, and I was wondering if there's any relationship between the type of waves that are given off by full-spectrum light and also the video display terminal.
These are two fairly separate research areas, but there is a great deal of interest in the effects of fluorescent lighting on human behavior. There are all sorts of different kinds of fluorescent lights you can buy, and there is one banker-turned-researcher, Mr. Ott, O-T-T, in Florida, has done some very suggestive experiments showing the impact of these fluorescent lights. But frankly, we haven't done very much research here again on the effects of fluorescent lights on health, and it begs more work.
And I thank you very much for calling. I wish we had time for more calls in this segment, but I guess to wrap it up, IBM is saying, don't worry, compute happy. You're skeptical about that, right?
I think that, you know, IBM's actions speak louder than their words. They have now shielded their terminals after saying for years that there was absolutely no risk. I hope that whatever they say, I'm glad to see, you know, that they are shielding the terminals, and now I hope that they will go and shield them for the other type of magnetic fields, ELF. And if I may say that, people who want to stay up with this field, you know, we are VDT News based in New York City, and we follow this very, very closely.
And Louis Flessen of Video Display Times, thank you very much for joining us on Soundbites.
Thank you.